This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Dean Kamen may be our best-known living inventor, famous for the wheelchair that climbs stairs and stands on two wheels, the first wearable infusion pump and insulin pump, and, of course, the Segway personal transporter. This and much more from a man who didn't graduate college, hated high school, and became a multimillionaire at 30. He still tinkers, but these days he focuses on devices he hopes will transform the world. A box that turns the most poisonous polluted muck into drinking water, a robotic arm that gives amputees a sense of touch, a car that runs on garbage, and in his spare time, he preaches the benefits of science and technology to more than 200,000 students every year through his robotics competition. Later in this hour, Common Knowledge tells us that the murder rate jumps in a down economy, so why did it drop? But first, inventors, call and tell us what you're working on and what inspired you to concentrate on science and technology. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you'll also find us on Twitter at TOTN. Dean Kamen is the founder of DECA Research and Development and joins us today from a studio at New Hampshire Public Radio. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's nice to be here.
And when you start to take on a project, do you start with an idea about technology and gee whiz, this could do that? Or do you start by looking at a problem and saying, how do I solve it?
I wish I could give you a simple answer to that very fair and reasonable question. I think it typically is a little bit of each. Typically, you know about problems for many years. We all know about certain problems we wish we didn't have. Mm-hmm. And typically, you also watch as the world evolves new and better technologies capable of doing more things. And every once in a while, there seems to be an intersection where you realize some new technology that's suddenly available and affordable and reliable might be, in some new and different way, applied to some old problem that could really make a big difference.
Was there a first time when you were a kid and you started working with stuff? Were you teaching yourself about technology, about mechanics and electronics, or were you teaching yourself about, well, you know, gee, I'd like to invent something?
Actually, as a kid, I was less interested in the physical tinkering than thinking about what we would now call the physics as opposed to the engineering. I remember as a kid thinking more about, you know, watching the world go by and being amazed by how both complex but consistent and elegant it was. You know, why, you know, when you put that cold glass of water on the table, it kind of warms up in a very predictable way. You put that hot cup of chocolate on the table, it cools down. Things that are at room temperature never spontaneously get either hot or cold. You know, you drop a ball, it bounces. It bounces always lower and lower until it stops. How does it know? Does it remember? Does it have a computer? How does it do that? And watching the world go by fascinated me, and trying to understand its rules and its symmetries fascinated me. But as I got older, I realized that you could, through the world of physics, understand some of that stuff, but later on, through the rules of engineering, you could apply some of those understandings to creating products.
I was interested. I watched a film about your competition that you have. You started for high school students. It's called your organization's called FIRST, for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. And you do this for high school kids, and they try to all compete against each other. They're all given the same kinds of kits, and they each try to devise a robot that will do specific tasks better than other people will. It is specifically a competition. Why did you decide to set it up that way?
I decided to make a competition because FIRST was really an answer to a very, I think, large concern I have and a lot of people have in this country, which is so many kids in this country are literally not just interested in but obsessed by sports and by entertainment. And it so dominates our culture that it crowds out, in many cases, kids' ability to separate what are pastimes and distractions for what are important things they've got to do while they're young, like learn and become technically competent to be able to take on important careers in the future. And I realized there's no point in whining and complaining about the power of sports to push other things out. We're better off harnessing that power. So I said, what if we could take the venue of sports and the passion and the power that sports has in our culture, but put into it the science and technology content so that kids now can take that same passion and energy that they focus on becoming good at bouncing a ball and use that same kind of format, sports, to give them the capacity to get passionate, to excel, to become a varsity algebra person or a varsity physics person, or think really deeply about how to develop the skill sets to create the next generation of scientists, engineers, and innovators. If this country doesn't quickly return to a focus on creating the most innovative workforce this globe has, this country is going to continue, I think, to decline, and that would be pretty bad.
We're talking with Dean Kamen, who received the National Medal of Technology back in 2000. He's a member of the National Inventors Hall of Fame. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's talk with Fred. Fred's with us from Old Mission in Michigan.
Dean, good to talk to you again. We met about 10 years ago when you received the Da Vinci Award from the Michigan chapter of the Multiple Sclerosis Society, and we had a chance to chat. But since that time, I've been a mentor for our first robotics team here at Traverse City Central High School, which has been just marvelous. The program is fantastic. Just as you explained, it is on a level of sports, except this is a life skill. The comment I would make, it goes beyond the science and technology and the engineering. We have others involved in the project that help with fundraising, marketing, PR. So what we now have is a complete team that's just not the technical side of things. And, of course, that's what happens in the real world.
It sounds like a small corporation.
And it kind of is. And getting organized is a very big challenge. But the good news is there's the first website has a lot of resources, and so there's team-to-team mentoring, and these teams have never even met. They may be in another state, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. The question I'd have for Dean is that the only thing that bothers me a little bit, as you know, this Saturday we'll see the telecast and we'll get our project, and we got 6 weeks to get it done. Over the last few years, it seems the complexity of the game and the complexity of the robotics are getting a little bit significant, more significant than I think is manageable, particularly for what I call a fairly young team in terms of experience. Some teams have been involved in this for years, and so as the juniors and seniors graduate, they bring along the freshmen. So the team, despite every 4 years rolling over, at least every 4 years, they gain a lot of experience. We're fairly young, and
rookie teams are at a disadvantage. Are the competitions too complex, Dean Kamen?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for being a mentor and being a supporter and saying such positive things. And as you probably know, Michigan is a real powerhouse state for FIRST. But to your question, yeah, we agonize over that all the time. On the one hand, we want every year to add more really neat, cool, exciting technology to the kits. You know, the first year it was 10 pounds of junk in a box that we handed out about the size of a shoebox. This year it's 130 pounds of stuff, including very sophisticated computers, vision system, cameras, gyros, sensors. So on the one hand, every year we want to make it more exciting with more stuff for two reasons. One is you want the returning teams always to see a new and bigger challenge, so they stay with us, and we have well over 90% retention over the 18 years. But to your point, the frustration is we recognize that a rookie team that shows up for the first time in their 18th years and sees this incredible amount of technology can be intimidated. So yes, it's a real issue. Yes, we worry about it, but I'll give you a couple of answers. One, we work really hard to put enough stuff in the kit that even a relatively new, for instance, a rookie team, is still going to be able to come up with a solution that works, that can get them out on the field with a robot that they're going to be proud of and not frustrated by. Second, as you pointed out, the mentoring from team to team is phenomenal. We have over 85,000 engineers and scientists and mentors that donate their time all over the country now in nearly 2,000 of these high school teams, but we also have the kids from all these teams, hundreds of thousands of them, that work together mentoring each other and helping each other. So that sort of helps. And third, I would tell you that we also now have a number of different levels of competition. What we've been just talking about is FRC, the first robotics competition. It's kind of the capstone, the Super Bowl, the
varsity
level,
as you said.
The varsity. But we also have what we call First Tech Challenge, which is a kit of substantially smaller parts. You still have to design and build things, but the kit is more inclusive of what you need. And then we even have in a partnership with the Lego company, using the Mindstorms brick from Lego, we have something called not our Little League, but our first Lego League for the younger kids. And believe it or not, we even have something now called a Junior First Lego League for the really young kids that are being inspired by watching their older brothers and sisters participate in these other competitions.
So the T-ball equivalent of the robotics competition. Fred, thanks.
Exactly.
There's a great opportunity all the way from elementary school to high school. I'm working with a high school.
Well, I
got to tell you, it's an awesome thing to see, and it goes, as I mentioned earlier, way beyond the technical side of things. I think it's life's lessons that these kids will never, never forget. So thanks a lot for doing it, and we're looking forward to getting the game here on Saturday.
Good luck, Fred.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, and I think you're really, really going to like this year's game.
Or the documentary we just saw on the 2008 competition. It was great to see at the end one of the young women participating in it saying, you know, I was going to study law, but now I'm thinking about going into engineering.
I know. I think in a kind of comical way, when I give talks about why kids should get involved, typically people think we're just trying to save the kids that would otherwise drop out of school or not stay focused or end up, you know, not developing skill sets for exciting jobs. And it's true. We focus a lot on that. And I'm happy to tell you that 38% of the kids on these teams are women and minorities that most people would say would never participate.
But
I really do. I really do like being able to say we could also save one of your kids from going off to law school, and that's a big win.
More with Dean Kamen in a moment. Inventors, what are you working on? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can also zap us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When it comes to inventors, you don't get much bigger than Dean Kamen. President Clinton awarded him the National Medal of Technology, later inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. He also created FIRST, an organization that we've talked about that encourages students to get into science and technology. A film crew followed several of the teams from the 2008 competition for a TV documentary called Gearing Up. You can watch the full project online through a link at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Our focus this hour, America's future and how it's being created in basements and garages around the country. Inventors, call and tell us what you're working on and what inspired you to focus on science and technology. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You'll find us also on Twitter at TOTN. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jerry. Jerry with us from Tempe.
Yes, hi.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dean, first of all, thank you very much for being who you are and inspiring us inventors and the alike all across the world. You've been I've been reading your patents and all your newspaper articles and press releases for years now, and being an inventor myself has been very inspiring, so thank you.
Well, thank you.
I'm working on an invention that I've been working on for 4 years. We're on our third patent process right now, and I want inventors and your listeners out there to realize, keep going. Sometimes it's a tough road. Inventions don't always have to be technical, would be my advice. And I have an ergonomic backpack system that allows anywhere universal access. So the backpack carries all the gear everyone else is inventing, and the backpack can flow around the body at will. Mm. Blind people don't never have to set the backpack down. People in wheelchairs can use this backpack. Military and the like. So it's been tough. We have some investors. All the meetings you go to is really difficult to understand. For inventors sometimes, but Dean, comment, if you would, about the whole process, and what is your favorite part of the process? Maybe there's some information you can give us inventors out there.
I'm sure
Thank
it's
you.
Applying to the patent office.
Pardon?
Well, I think you summed up the process pretty well when you said lots of failures, never give up, keep working. You know, lots of people ask me for advice as if I somehow have found some easy way to create a solution to a problem, and there's no such thing. Every successful person I've ever seen has one characteristic, and it, some are well-educated, some are not. Some seem to be just gifted in some way, you know, some great mental gift. No matter what you look for in a person, I think ultimately, particularly in somebody who's trying to innovate, the most consistent characteristic required for their success is tenacity. It's hard to try to do something new. It's hard to do things that haven't been done before. And even once you do it, it's hard to convince other people that have never seen something that has been done that way before that they should give up what they're doing, even if they don't like what they're doing. People are very reluctant to change. So there are really two parts of every invention process. One is actually make something that really solves a real need, and the second is convince people and organizations that they have to start doing something differently than they were doing before. That's generally a long and frustrating process.
Right, here's Seth.
Thank you. I have one quick question. I could take this off the air if need be, unless you have questions for me. What is your most favorite aha moment you've had, and where was it? Like, wham, in the shower? Was it driving somewhere? Was it in a conference? Do you have a favorite, like a tear-in-your-eye moment where you realize that the invention is going to work and it's going to be able to be useful in society?
You know, I'm also asked by lots of people these days, what's the best project we've ever done? And my answer is now my safest and truest answer. I don't know. It hasn't happened yet. Every year that goes by, I have more smart people. We have better technology available to us. We have more experience. And so we take on bigger and we hope more potentially valuable projects. You know, we started making specialty medical products when my older brother was in med school. We started making pumps for him to treat babies with cancer, a very small population. We later expanded that to being able to make insulin pumps for diabetics, a much bigger population. Today, we're working on ways to make clean water for the developing world. Over a billion people every year are sick or dead because they don't have it. We're trying to work on ways to make electricity in remote places at the point of use using fuels that would cause more environmental impact. In fact, we're trying to develop technologies that will collect stuff that is left to its own devices, making the environment worse. So these are sort of like electric generators that are vacuum cleaners that suck bad stuff out of the environment and turn it into electricity. So my long answer to your short question, what was our best project or our best aha moment? I hope it hasn't happened yet. I think young is about looking forward and being optimistic and wondering what's next. Being old is looking backward and wishing for times gone by, and I hope never to get old.
We're at the beginning of a new decade, a new year. From your perspective, what do you think, you know, as you look ahead, what's likely to be a next breakthrough? Or if you knew, you'd obviously be even richer than you are now.
Well, as I said, we're working very hard on some of our energy-related projects, like our Stirling generator. We're working very hard on developing a realistic, practical way to make point-of-use water available all over the world. We're working, of course, my day job, on all our medical projects. We're trying to make a bunch of technologies that right now have to happen in a hospital, which is, A, an expensive setting, and, B, not a very appealing setting for most people. We're trying to take some core technologies and make them available for therapies that people can self-administer at home, for instance, daily dialysis of all kinds. That would dramatically reduce the cost of these therapies. It would dramatically improve the outcomes, and it would give people lots of choices to have a better quality of life. So we're very busy, as I say, in my day job, medical stuff, and my day job is mostly there to feed my fantasies and to fund my fantasies, like supporting our first competitions all over the country and now the world, and supporting some of my other projects, water and power, that right now don't have the support of major corporate clients or government agencies yet, because they're still in that stage where most people would say they're too high risk.
Well, we have a question by email on one of those projects from Gary in Marietta, Georgia. Where do we stand on the artificial limb for amputees? What's the status of VA and U.S. government funding?
So that's a really terrific project. Thank you for that question. We not only finished the first generation of those prosthetic limbs, but we delivered some down to the Veterans Administration recently to actually be on people full-time in a clinical trial setting. We've been out to BAMC, Fort Brooks in Texas. We've been down to Walter Reed. The response we're getting from the military, from DARPA, from the Veterans Administration, from the docs and from the families and from these kids is just astounding. So we've redoubled our efforts to finish the next generation. We should be putting new prosthetic arms on patients early this coming year, and we're hoping to be able to start supplying them in quantities to meet the needs as quickly as we can.
Let's go next to Allison. Allison with us from Norwell in Massachusetts.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to thank you, Dean, for the first team, robotics teams. I coach a team and have been coaching a team for the past 4 years for the 9 to 12-year-olds. And my daughter has recently become involved as well. And I think it's a real wonderful thing to give girls exposure to this science and technology.
Well, I thank you for being a mentor, and having women mentors is almost as important to me as having more young girls on the teams, because the very powerful cultural stereotype that somehow has evolved in this country that science and technology and engineering and inventing is somehow not for women is astounding to me, and it cheats virtually 50% of our population out of aspiring to do some of the most fun and most exciting things people can do and some of the great careers people can have. So make sure your daughter stays involved. Make sure goes on up through the rest of these programs and on into high school, and then maybe we'll see her as a mentor when she gets into college.
Absolutely, and thank you for making it fun for them, because it's really putting some real-world experience in their hands.
Allison, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
I made a joke earlier about the fun part of the process being the patent application. You have hundreds of patents, but some people say the patent office has become so bureaucratic that it's actually stifling creativity at the moment.
Well, I would strongly disagree that the patent office is in any way stifling creativity, but I will tell you, I'm not sure it's bureaucratic. It's the problem that it's got such a huge backlog. You know, most businesses would be thrilled with backlogs, because when they get a backlog, they quickly grow, they respond, they hire people. But government agencies don't have that flexibility. And so what's happened is, as the value of intellectual property has gone up, and as people have realized the value of patents, there's been an explosion of patent applications. And in some categories, you now have to wait years, literally 2-3 years, before you can get an action on a patent, and it's called pendency. And there are something like 500,000 patent applications sitting at the patent office waiting to be examined. And I have strongly urged anybody in Washington that will listen to me, senators and congressmen, that if there's any piece of our stimulus package that's going to have big returns for this country, it would be to support the patent office, support the patent system, get them more resources, give them what they need to more quickly and more efficiently start reviewing and issuing high-quality patents, because they, by issuing those patents, they are creating the opportunity for people to literally create wealth as they solve problems, as they give the world solutions to problems. But I think the patent office is a very it's an unsung hero of the American culture and the American economy, and it needs more support.
This email from Joseph: I'm an independent inventor myself with nearly 250 U.S. and international patents, and I'm concerned about proposed changes in the patent system. I'm wondering if Dean, as an independent inventor, has any comment on large companies' current attempts to change the patent system to what appears to be their advantage.
Well, sadly, I think he's got a reason to be concerned. I think there is a movement now to create a patent reform, as they call it, and I think some of it inevitably will be good. But I share his concern that there's a lot going on in that patent reform package that could either as an unintended consequence or sadly as it gets gamed by the people that use or take advantage of the patent system, there are things in that package that may undermine the value of patents or make them more difficult for small inventors to get and to hold on to. I have strongly urged, again, all those people in the process to make sure that whatever reforms go into place, they should make certainty better, not worse. They should make the time it takes to get a patent examined and issued shorter, not longer. They should ensure that the quality of that patent is good, even if it makes it harder to get one, but that once you are the holder of a patent, you can count on it. More importantly, the people that you're going to go ask to invest in your invention can count on it. So I think he's concerned about some legitimate potential issues, and I hope that the public and particularly our representatives in Washington, think long and hard and are very careful before they implement any changes to the patent system that don't strengthen it.
Dean Kamen, founder of DECA Research and Development, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go next to Darcy. Darcy with us from Empire in Colorado.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say, Dean Kamen, you've always been my hero ever since I heard about Fred and Ginger. And I'm not an inventor, but I've had an idea ever since then that I would love to just share with you as a nurse. I think it would be a wonderful idea to have some kind of a transport system that could move quadriplegics and exercise their arms and legs at the same time and actually get to go somewhere. I think it'd be very valuable for quadriplegics and stroke patients, anybody that's had nerve damage, because I know that if you can keep those limbs moving, that you're more likely maybe to get some nerve back, and I think you're the guy that could do that or put it out for competition.
Well, I think you'd be happy to know that while this is a constant area of research, and as you know, rehab medicine is a pretty big field, but I think you'd be happy to know that literally over just the last couple of years, there are some pretty big breakthroughs in the research, in the understanding of the neurology that are allowing better machines to be put out there that can be used by paraplegics and quadriplegics to exercise their limbs in such a way that actually they're demonstrating now that they can restore function that people thought was gone forever. So it's a very active field all of a sudden. Lots of progress is being made, and machines for rehab and for exercise are coming now at a pace higher than they have in at least all the time I've been looking at this field.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I think if they could actually take the person somewhere, they'd get a lot more out of it, though.
All right, Darcy. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Let's see if we can get one last caller in. This is Nick. Nick with us from Kalamazoo.
Yes. Okay, Dean, this is something that's come to my attention. My brother is an instructor in the wood shop and the other mechanical arts in the school system here. He has just received notice that his shop is going to be closed in June. Funding, blah, blah, blah. There has been another four shops in the southeast or southwest Michigan area that have been closed down just in this last 9 months. If we can't teach people to work with their hands, they don't think mechanically. I'll let it go from there.
Well, sadly, I have to agree with you that, A, the trend has been lots of schools are cutting out anything that, whether it's the extra funding or they think it's a distraction from a, quote, academic curriculum. That trend has been going on, and I agree with you. Giving people skill sets where they can work with their hands, not as much just to develop that eye-hand coordination, but really to develop the ability to use their brain to take some abstract idea and then using that wonderful opposed thumb and ability of humans to create tools that can then be used to create inventions, that is a very valuable and underrated skill set. And for some reason, again, the culture of the United States has for reasons that I don't understand, put a damper on almost any kind of education-based program that actually gives kids those kinds of skill sets. And I think we've got to reverse that trend. And one of the reasons that FIRST, I think, works so well and is so exciting to the kids is because it gets them out into industry where there's all sorts of incredibly sophisticated robotic tools, laser cutters, and they can see that building tools and understanding tools shouldn't be considered a menial function, but it's one of the great achievements of humanity.
Can you stay with us over the break?
Sure.
All right, Dean Kamen's with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with James Fox from Northeastern University about the drop in crime rates, a statistic which surprised a lot of people in a time economic hard times. But we wanted to finish up a conversation we're having with the inventor, Dean Kamen. And we got this email from Barbara in Goodrich, Michigan. Thanks, Dean, for your work with FIRST Robotics. My daughter is attending a United World College, which is a high school in Bosnia. Thanks to confidence given to her by being a drive team captain for FIRST Robotics, she has talked the school into forming a FIRST team in Bosnia. It will have Croatian, Bosnian, and Serbian team members and will do a small part for world peace. The rookie team is being mentored by a former national championship team from Goodrich, Michigan. So there's an international aspect to the FIRST robotics competition. I also wanted to go to this email from Sarah that we got from Columbia, Missouri. Do innovative people ever think this idea is so unusual it might actually be stupid, only to perhaps later see it successfully implemented by someone else?
Well, the second comment, yes, I think that happens all the time. Almost the more outrageous an idea appears up front, the more likely it is that down the road, in some version, it might come to life. To your first set of comments about FIRST being a tool of international diplomacy, a way to bring kids all over the world to focus on building things together instead of distrusting each other or learning how to destroy things, you need to know that while we started in this country, literally the little country of Israel is holding a regional this year in March. There'll be teams there from Turkey, from many other countries, Israel, a number of the Arab states will be sending teams. It's quite an astounding thing and a gratifying thing to realize that kids not only can learn technology, but they can avoid learning the things that each generation has taught them in the past about why they should hate and distrust each other. Science and technology are one universal truth. It's an unintended consequence, but a very powerful consequence we see of what's happening with the growth of FIRST. And the story that young girl developed great confidence to go do this because of FIRST, again, I can assure you, is not a unique experience. What we end up seeing, and what I tell a lot of the parents after their kids work so hard at doing this, is that we don't expect all these kids to be scientists and engineers and choose that as a career. That's not the point. It's to give them an option. It's to let them see that it's possible. But mostly, in 6 or 7 weeks in a robotics competition, nobody believes they're really going to learn all of engineering or even a substantial amount of engineering or physics or math or anything else. What they really build in that 6 weeks is not a robot. They're building self-confidence. They're building serious relationships. They're building all sorts of important life lessons in a context that puts kids together with serious adults in a positive way.
Well, let's get a caller in. This is Bob. Bob with us in Boise.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious if your guest has an opinion on public domain inventions, inventions that are just not patented, just set out for public use.
This is the equivalent of open source in computers?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
I think those people that will put their time and their effort and their energy into creating something and then put it in the public, that's great. A lot of us do things for monetary reasons. A lot of us do things for other reasons. There's a lot of philanthropy in the world. I think that's great. One caution, however, I'd give you is that if some great new idea is put into the public and then it's going to take an enormous amount of money to turn that great new idea into something that actually can be produced and used, ironically, an unintended consequence might be that nobody will put that kind of time, money, resource into creating that new thing, because if they can't keep, for instance, the protection that a patent would give them, they'll see no way to get a return on their investment. So while I think it's frankly naive and a little overly simplistic to say that a patented object or the patent process might increase the price of some things by, let's say, the value of a royalty, I think people forget that it's the ultimate incentive to create new things, and typically the new things people create are created because they can do a job better or simpler or cheaper than the other alternative. But unless there's an incentive to create that newer, better, simpler, cheaper system, it might not get done. And even if the idea of how to do it is now available, if that cannot be protected and the incentive is removed, you may never see that great new idea become a reality.
Thanks. I mean, I think there's often ideas that don't get put forth because there is no broad commercial value to them, more of a specific market. And if things were in public domain, then, you know, incrementally our lives could improve through these different inventions, different ideas. And I'm also curious about just putting things out in public domain and having a protection from that, the same way that that one computer program, the Linus, was protected.
Anyway, Bob, thanks very much for the call. We're going to have to move on. We appreciate it. Dean Kamen, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Dean Kamen joins us today from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, talking about his first robotics competition, which gets underway this weekend. So you may want to participate in that.